Welcome, everyone, to On-Chain Alpha. This is our weekly podcast where we explore the world of on-chain data. We're unpacking valuable insights and novel applications with on-chain, with the people, who are building the most innovative data infrastructure analytics platforms and writing your favorite threads on X and now Farcaster as well. So please make sure to sign up to our newsletter. CryptoSapiens.xyz is where you can find it. On-Chain Alpha is possible because of people like Mosaic, the Optimism Collective, and Bankless DAO. Thank you for your support. Today, we're talking to Sarup, co-founder of Powerloom. I am excited to learn more about this wonderful project because there was some interesting insights that I got from Sarup about like what you were doing prior to starting Powerloom. So why don't you give us an introduction to yourself and then really tell us a story about like how Powerloom was started.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me here. Hi, everyone. My name is Sarup. I'm one of the co-founders of Powerloom Protocol. I've been in crypto for just about 7 years now, but been in tech for a couple of decades, building a bunch of different companies, always been an entrepreneur. Never really had a job. I don't think I'm very hireable anyway. So that's kind of what I've been doing in crypto when I first got into it. Interestingly, I was actually very early into Bitcoin and stuff, but I don't think I really went as deeper beyond using Bitcoin. So that was my early way because I always believed it to be a peer-to-peer currency because I originally hail from India. And for me, this was like this always this pain point. And it's very hard to explain to somebody where, you know, you got to move money around. And that was such an automatic thing that attracted me to Bitcoin. And then there was like this huge gap, I would say, probably, I don't know, maybe from 2011, 2012 till 2017, till I discovered Ethereum. Before starting Powerloom, I was building a developer tool in a space called BlockVisual. That was essentially my first sort of big project. And for those who have used Matic before they became Polygon, and even as they sort of transitioned, we were pretty much the main infra provider as well. So that was kind of a middle pivot, I would say, the COVID year pivot, where everybody was trying to figure out how do we survive. And that's one of the things we did. And of course, the rest is history because they took off like crazy, and so did we in terms of being that infrastructure. And the story of how sort of got into Powerloom is actually because of that, because we went from doing probably a million API calls a day with just one customer called Polymarket, which is very popular again this year. It was actually the last US election, so I remember that very clearly. This was probably towards end of 2020, probably September, October. I think that's when the elections come out, right? So, and we sort of grew that out like crazy, and it was all organic. Just me and my current co-founder building that as well. And we almost became the solo infrastructure for Matic, and then it became Polygon, and that also created so much pressure. I remember we literally, it sounds like an exaggeration that we 1000x'd, but there is, if you go through my older tweets, you will see that we did, because I was documenting my journey, and we went from that million to a billion calls a day in like a matter of 6 months. But that also meant we were kind of the single point of failure. So if something went wrong, especially like it was hard to keep up, you know, the software and everything was also hard. And it was also new for us. Like, you're dealing with real traction, which is hard to find in our space, and real customers who are paying, and then people who are dependent on it, right? There are all these, every DeFi protocol, everyone was using us at one point. So I think that's kind of what got us thinking as to, we really need to solve this problem. So we sort of ditched what was doing really well to build Powerloom as a protocol, because we decided we wanted on-chain data to be more accessible and, of course, be more efficient, more decentralized. And that's how we sort of started Powerloom. The story is much longer, but I was like,
That's good.
It's a one-hour podcast. We're going to...
We could spend a whole hour just talking about
it.
Like, tell me more exactly about that story. But no, obviously, we want to cover Powerloom. You know... Yeah. First of all, I want to touch on something that you talked about, which is like forever the entrepreneur and not being hireable. I feel that so hard. For me, like my entrepreneurial journey started before even coming into Web3. I love working with others. Okay, this is my LinkedIn resume right now. Works well with others. but there's just something that it's hard about working on things that are not inspiring to you, that aren't meaningful to you. And I think the entrepreneurial journey is just like always finding things that resonate with you, that mean something, that you feel like will make an impact and you don't mind being associated with, you know, whether it succeeds or fails. And to me, that's the excitement about the entrepreneur journey. I just wonder if that's kind of like the same for you, like why you're just like the forever entrepreneur.
I mean, I think so. It took me a while to figure it out, even though I started at a younger age. I was probably 16 or something when I started my first venture. I'm 38 now, so it's more than 20 years. I keep saying two decades. It's actually more now.
Yeah.
So I guess I need to update it every year mentally. I do feel old as I sort of talk about it. But it was probably about 5-6 years ago. I remember this was before I got into crypto and I sold my last company, which I thought was like, this is the exit. It was basically ended up being one of the worst things that happened. I had to walk away and break all those, what we call as golden handcuffs. So I walked away with like nothing. I was like, I had built all this value and now I had nothing. And now I didn't even have my company. And that's kind of when I was trying to understand what had I done wrong. And because it looked like this was that success after a string of failures. And, you know, one thing that people don't understand is they always think entrepreneurship is this whole glamorous thing because the media shows you either the highs or the lows, isn't that right? Like that's kind of what we always see, right? Like the downfalls or the up. Nobody really talks about the in between, which is usually the struggle to get to the top. And of course, I've also now understood and humbled in that sense that just being at the top doesn't mean anything because you can just fall down as quickly. As a matter of fact, you fall way faster. So there's that point of it. And then I started to learn from the failure. So I actually treated my biggest success as my biggest failure. And that's when I started rethinking. So this is probably 2015, 2016, when it really hit me. What is the strength? What is it that takes? And it's actually perseverance, because it's a sort of a fine line between being crazy and being perseverant. Like in terms of like pursuing something because you don't know if it's going to be successful. Even now, like I say this often, even about Powerloom. This is the first company or the project that I've started pre-funded, because like we literally got funded on a napkin sketch. And then before we even went like super full time into it, we were funded by, you know, some bit of venture capital. I never had that opportunity prior to that, right? In any of my companies. But even this journey in the last 3 years, and I still continue to think that we don't know whether it's going to succeed. And it's you're sort of running the sort of a marathon, right? And through whether it's all these bull cycles, bear cycles. I personally am not a fan of bull cycles. I think it's too distracting. I have to sort of keep my team excited and all those things. But the point is that you're building something long term, and that's what you have to believe in. Things will change while you get there. Like you, when you're doing what you're doing right now, it's harder when you probably got started. It was probably a little bit of that initial high that you get like, oh, I'm starting something new, but then it very quickly just goes away, right? So, and I think I tell most people, it sucks, don't do this. This is opposite of what I used to say before. I used to judge everyone who used to have a job. And now I'd say people that, no, stick to what you are enjoying, because this is not something that's easy, because you're sacrificing personal relationships and, you know, health and finances and all those things. And you don't even know if it's going to work out. So, yeah.
Yeah, you definitely can't be, what is it, risk averse. Like, you definitely need to be willing to take risks. Like, it has to be in your nature. And you have to almost have like a very thick skin, because it's a lot of pain, you know, for everything that you describe. So definitely the entrepreneur journey, not for everyone, but for those who certainly have the qualities, it's a wonderful experience. Because again, for the reasons, at least for myself, it's like you get to do things that you truly believe in. You get to bring together people who you really think are just amazing human beings to build with you, because that also is a big part of it, right? It's like, who is building this with you? Who's along this journey? Because you do not want to have people around you most of the day, every day, that you don't really care about, or that are like really bringing you down. Like, you need to make sure that these people have the right energy also. So absolutely.
I think that's even better put.
just my personal experience is all. So yeah, let's jump into this in terms of like Powerloom. So you talked about kind of its genesis before it was Powerloom, you know, in terms of the business you built and the customers that you had. I mean, Polygon is no small player in this industry, probably one of the top five, if probably not one of the top three in this ecosystem in terms of the quality of infrastructure, products, team, business development, projects building on Polygon. You know, it's got tons of visibility and a huge reputation, good reputation based on the impact that it's made. What are some of your thoughts in terms of kind of going from, this builder that's just kind of working in a very narrow scope, just like supporting Polygon, to kind of developing this platform that is built for, I guess, a much wider customer base with kind of similar impact and application?
Yeah, I think we sort of already had that. We were creating that impact even at that point, because before we built that service for the Polygon ecosystem, or the Matic ecosystem is what it was called. When we were building that developer tooling, there was keeping in mind that it's for, at least for all EVM chains, right? At that point, honestly, that was it. So I remember working very early with the Solana team, because I used to sit next to them. I used to even crash at one of the co-founders' houses when I used to live in San Francisco. Very different times from then to now. And I sort of had this thesis that, okay, this is what is taken off, and this is what we need to be supporting. We don't know what's going to change. One of the things, it's kind of ironic, and I was just refreshing my memory as you were talking about it. We ourselves were building what I internally called an L2 project. Now, L2 was not a very hype word in 2019. So I remember we built ours, and then I saw what JD at Matic had built, and I'm like, why should we compete? We should just build on top of theirs, which is the best decision, I'd say. But if you think about it, I sort of guessed that scaling solution. And even now, right, that's kind of the hot thing that's everyone's moving towards. We almost, with the recent fork that happened with Ethereum, that's now the de facto thing. You will be using layer twos to sort of do that. And that was always this running joke of whether Polygon POS is an L2 or not. That was the constant thing at that time. But data is data, right? So if you are as a provider, whether it's a developer tool or we were the RPC provider, you're still looking at every chain as sort of a data set. And as long as you build it in an agnostic way, at least a product, you can sort of support multiple ecosystems from day one, right? So we always kept that in mind. I remember this very well, that we wanted to support multiple ecosystems. The next is traction itself, because if you don't have customers and if you don't have users, you can support the best tech in the world. This is one thing that I always tell people. It's kind of funny. I said this recently publicly. I didn't admit it back then. I said Polygon POS is not the best tech. ZKVM is their best tech. They have the most amazing team that has gone built. But it's actually traction-wise, it's still Polygon PS which has the traction. So in the end, which one do you want to as an outsider, how do you sort of go about it? But then you're also future-proofing and you're building, and there's a more, as an entrepreneur, or Sandeep, he's a good friend, and we've sort of seen through a lot of things together. It's sort of the vision, right? You're building for the future, and certain things you're sort of attacking for the immediate need. And that's kind of where with Powerloom, our path was that, okay, there's this immediate need for getting access to that on-chain data. And especially when you sort of sit and run analysis, or when you, it's not just raw blockchain data, but then when you have to transform it, you're using all these protocols or centralized services, that really bothered me. I remember thinking this is what's the point of Web3 if we just sit and use some sort of a hosted service to pull that? And just because it was hard, right? It's not because I'm saying a certain other protocol doesn't do what Powerloom does. We have a different approach to some others out there, but that was that whole, as we sort of take a bet between decentralization and reliability and all those things. So that's kind of where you start to make certain decisions, right? And of course, the ecosystem itself has also evolved more, I feel in the last 3 years. And that's what has given us more conviction that, okay, we are on the right path, but also means there's more people to, there are other new things as well that you've got to keep up.
Yeah. So I guess walk us through how Powerloom works, right? How is it different from what you built before? How can a developer get started with it today?
So one thing I like to, our pitch right now is we say we are this composable data network. And again, for the listeners, I like to use some analogies sometimes. Let me try this one. This is actually something that's on our documentation as well. So when we say, what is Powerloom in a nutshell? So it's analogous to like some sort of like a decentralized library catalog for blockchain data, right? So imagine if there's like a library, but the difference is that we have this concept, and I'll go deeper into it, called snapshotters. So these are essentially your librarians, but they are continuously observing these shelves of books, which is essentially smart contracts, and like cataloging whether it's additions, removals of books, changes in existing books. This is very hard to imagine because a real library doesn't work like that, but an online library kind of does, and to some extent, but you still have books. And so then adding more notes, which are added by readers and all those things. So that's kind of what we are in a nutshell, right? We are just this decentralized library catalog for blockchain data. And that's kind of where we see ourselves as like very the core of what we do. But the biggest difference is, at least I can give you what we were doing before to what Powerloom is doing versus our previous project. Previous project, purely an RPC provider. So we would run the notes and we give you raw data. As simple as that. You could do some bit of indexing and few things on it. I think I remember we used to do some sort of centralized indexing on it, but that was, again, not something most people used. They needed that dApps would sort of consume that. And then others who would use, let's say, if they're using other protocols like Graph and others, they would also consume that, run that through that protocol, and then utilize it in ways. So like Aave, Uniswap, who are our customers. And those are also our first use cases, because we were like, okay, we need to solve their problems, right? And then there was this concept of scale that they would always run into. And the biggest difference is that the decentralization angle of it, right? Because we are one provider, which is giving you that data. How do you know that that response is actually accurate, right? So it's not verified. So most people would have redundancy built into it. They would actually talk to multiple providers and get that exact same data, which is like, I'm like, this beats the purpose. Why are we doing this, right? Like that was the most simplest thing, to be honest. That is what was like my aha moment. I'm like, I saw how they were all using it. And I'm like, we got to be able to solve this in a better way. I mean, we are in Web3. If we have to sort of do all these extra centralization logic and do redundancies, it just beats the purpose, right? So that's one. And second is when you actually take raw data and then you sort of analyze, and when you transform it, for example, you're looking at, so one of the first use cases we built was on top of Uniswap, which is this info page of Uniswap. So if anyone goes to info.uniswap.org, I think they have a very new one that came out this month, which combines all those ones. But the concept is still the same. This is, you're looking at the top tokens, what's happening every block and how it gets updated. That is not something that you can get from on-chain data directly. You still have to sort of run some sort of logic and compute. And that's where that centralization and who will watch the watchman? This is one of my favorite quotes, right? How do you sort of trust that? So we sort of take a little bit of, I think in the industry, it's sort of a de facto thing that, oh, we're okay with this acceptable partial decentralization. And that's kind of where we were like, no, this can be easily solved. So, and I'll take that as an example itself, because our use case has been live. It's one of the first things we showcased what Powerloom can do. So when you use Powerloom, one, that final data set is something that lives on-chain with a proof. So you don't even have to trust what happened in between. I mean, obviously you can go and verify, but the idea is that that final thing is not something that's being queried from some sort of a centralized service. So let's say Swaroop or Humdi or anybody else who wants that data will come back with that exact same hash. So for example, we use IPFS just to showcase this for the public usage. And that exact same IPFS CID, if you're running especially Brave, you will just fetch it straight away. So your front-end interface to my front-end interface is exactly the same result, at least at that particular epoch, right? Now, behind the scenes, what the magic that does happen is we have this concept of what I already used this term called snapshotters. So these are these peers in our ecosystem, right? So they're the ones who are taking all these data points and reaching consensus for every sort of every time we need to generate a data set, right? So you and I could be running that node. And for example, at the moment, and we can talk about a bit more into detail what we are doing these days, but we have over 5,000 peers right now in the Powerloom network, in our current testnet as well. But it could be just a few of them. It doesn't matter, right? We define for this business logic, or whoever is the consumer, you decide that, okay, I need this much, these many peers, I'm willing to pay X amount of money to the protocol. And these peers feel like we are incentivized to run this data set for you. And it the more complex it is, the more powerful Powerloom actually gets. The less, if it's just raw data of like, hey, give me this current block of Ethereum, I would say that you're better off running an Ethereum node because that's just way easier. So that's kind of where we really, really excel. And of course, I can go deeper. Like I said, I can probably talk about it for a whole hour.
Yeah,
but
well, I mean,
I'll sort of stop there.
No, that's fine. But you brought up a couple of points that I really kind of want to expand on. And so instead of like going so deep in one thing, I think that you brought up a few things that I want to surface back up. One of the things you talked about was like the service in terms of how it works. I have some questions there in terms of maybe how it compares to some of the other folks that have come through the On-Chain Alpha podcast. We had Covalent on. That was our first guest. Then we also had Nainar. So I kind of want to look at that from the decentralized social perspective and maybe relate a little bit. So the first one I'll touch on, just because personally for me it's the most fun, because I am so deep in the decentralized social space, specifically Farcaster. When you talk about, you know, the service that you used to provide, you used to run a node. This reminds me of like how if you want to verify data on Farcaster, you can run a node, right? And you can basically just get that raw data. That's basically what you were operating before. You're running a node, just providing that raw data.
However, and Farcaster uses OP?
Yeah, they use Optimism, but they run their own hubs, right? So those hubs are the way that you can run a hub, and then you basically are able to get all the raw data for yourself, but it's, you know, raw. It doesn't really necessarily make any sense. Then you have providers like Nainar who run their own hub, but then they provide these services on top of that where you can easily call that information in a neatly packaged format, right, through an API. So what I'm hearing is maybe...
Which is what we were. Like, we were, like, basically the Nainars for, like, the Infuriators of the world.
Got
like,
it, yes, the correct. Of the world.
Yes.
So now, Powerloom, it sounds like you're building the infrastructure so that anybody can become the Nainar of a Farcaster protocol. But in this case, we're not looking at just a decentralized social protocol. We're looking at actual blockchains.
And I could expand just on the social one so that you can understand as well. So, for example, if you were to pull... what are the top, let's say the last 10 casts that you have done across multiple channels and with some more relations? So if you sit and build all that business logic, Nainar itself won't give it to you. Maybe there's some possibility to it, but that's where the protocol, it could still be consuming it from Nainar or the hubs itself, right? Like this is the good thing. Like Nainar could just essentially be the source, the initial source of that data. The truth is what do I usually say. So you run your hubs. And then you run this through a business logic that, let's say, you and I hacked together at probably at a hackathon. Maybe we should have done it at the ETH Global one 2 days ago. This would have been fun. I'll talk about it, what we are doing soon in the next one. But so if you and I hacked together, we would build this sort of a use case where all we are saying that, hey, I care about these sort of different data sets, but now I need to analyze certain data, right? Because I need to like... cross and join, and especially if what if it's also across multiple chains? That's also another advantage because, like, maybe it's not just Farcaster, it's probably some more data that is coming from different sources. So, that's kind of where Powerloom actually becomes very beneficial because that final resulting data set, which by the way, can just be just one big dump of a JSON or a CSV or whatever you want to consume it as an API, that now is much easier to consume and you're not really querying a centralized service. That's the biggest difference because right now with a lot of these providers and not to sort of piss on other protocols, but they all have some sort of, even if they claim to be decentralized, they still have their sort of what we call them nodes who are hosted nodes, which you have to query. And you don't know if they've actually provided that data correctly. Of course, they're working on ways to verify that and all those things. But our thing is like, we've kind of already solved it because that's our approach from day one. And that makes it super easy. And then that data set can be much easily, let's say, consumed by Wobcast or some other client, which probably doesn't even have to query all this because it can just literally fetch from an IPFS CID. And it knows that that data set is also reliable and accurate because... you know, you, me, and hundreds of other snapshotters have gone and done the exact same thing. So that's the biggest difference, yeah.
So
you've just given me an idea in my head. Now I'm gonna. I just finished a DevRel call before this.
I love it.
So we were just thinking, what at the next hackathon, what can we do? And obviously, you know, Prateek is like a very big Farcaster user. So we were like, okay, we should probably give some idea for that as well. And this would be cool.
Yeah, the proof is in the data. I think Prateek just literally tweeted out today, this morning, that he hit the top 5 casts on Farcaster or Warpcast are his. So. Yeah. Congratulations.
Twitter is not as popular anymore as this podcaster. I think that's the case with a lot of people I'm seeing who are active there. I think I missed the boat. I was very early to, because I was one of the early people who got access to it, but I was like, oh, no one's here. So I used to just cast in my, like no one was there, right? Nobody would like, nobody would see that cast. And there was only the founder and a few people who would reply, and that was it. And I missed this initial the last 3 months of craziness that's been happening.
It's
especially DGen and stuff.
Yeah, it's been really good to see it grow. Personally, I was not that early. I came in 2022 after, like,
it's still early.
Yeah, I mean, comparatively to a lot of people, yes. I'm sub 10,000. I think my fit is like 2800 or something like that. So,
oh, you're definitely older than me.
Yeah. but you know, like, it's been really wonderful to see like the developments there, and just generally I think it's been really fun. One of the things that you talked about that I really kind of want to maybe not expand on, but just get your thoughts, especially because it sounds like you have an idea what you're going to do on the next hackathon, but just that hackathons in general, and like what you think are the value metrics, value points of participating. I'll give you my two gwei on that. That simply is, I participate, no matter what I'm building, who I'm collaborating with, I try to, as regularly as I can, participate in hackathons, because to me, that is the best way to connect with the people who are sponsoring, like the presenting partners of that hackathon. For me, I was like, I'm already building on hackathon. There's a lot of things that I've got in the, you know, on the burners, what I'm cooking. I was like, what better way for me to connect with the founders of AirStack, you know, the founders of Privy, like all of these folks that are supporting it. It's like, you just go to a hackathon, literally hack together something. It doesn't have to be perfect. It could be super janky, but at the end of the day, you can make some really good connections with the people who are moving this space forward. And I think in Farcaster, if you look at all the presenting sponsors of that event, the Frameworks Hackathon, a lot of them really have made the decentralized social space that much more interesting, and definitely in the Farcaster ecosystem. So just generally want to hear your thoughts about hackathon. And, you know, obviously you got something working in your brain right now. So like, how would you want to get involved, or Powerloom get involved?
Yeah, I mean, we're officially involved with ETH Global for the entire year. We announced it probably a couple of weeks ago. So we were not at the Frames ones, because these are those pop-up ones that happen more in real time. But if you notice, the upcoming one is Scaling Ethereum. We were just trying to plan for that as well. It's the first virtual hackathon of the year, where there is obviously more time, right? Because most of the hackathons, like I was a judge at the ETH Global one, which was in person. And by the way, I saw 15 projects I judged at the finals, and there were 13 of them were on Farcaster. They were doing something on Farcaster, which is crazy. I was like, I was thinking about Prateek at that time. I'm like, he would be so happy to see everyone. He's doing something there. But that's kind of, it's also the trend that I always notice, right? So, and with ETH Global, obviously, you know, things go way back. I've been a mentor there for a long time. I try to see what others do. And it's also good feedback for us, right? We were very early to be sponsors in the first 2 years. So we were trying to learn. And we did a couple of them. We did like the India one, because some of my teammates are based in India. So it's a little logistically a little more easier to do that. But the virtual one is something I'm very excited about, because it's actually more time. So when you have like 2-3 weeks, you can really build something a bit more meaningful, because one thing I have noticed, that it's super exciting to build something over 2 days, and then people just like, oh, okay, either they won it or they didn't win it, and they're like, I don't want to continue beyond that. And that does give a little more time, and I think you can build something more meaningful. On, for those who will Google, they will find out that Powerloom was actually built at one of those in 2020. Yeah, actually twice, because the initial one was not Powerloom. It was like a use case in a way. And then the next one was us, probably ETH Online. It was called Order Protocol. That was like our code name for it. And that was what we presented at a ETH Global Hackathon. And this is like, it's for me, it's like, it's still like, it's dog fooding too. And that's how I treat it. But now this year, we're making a much bigger commitment because we wanted to make sure that devs know about what we're doing. It's we're not as big as the other sponsors that you'll usually see there who have been established for, you know, quite some time. But this is where I think that it's the best way, because you can go about and like put out documentation. And if nobody comes to know about it, nobody's hacking, what's the point, right? Like, what's the point of building a protocol if there are no devs on it? And I think that's, and ours is definitely something new. So it does take, like, you know, now you have some idea of what we do at Powerloom, but it's with others, like you gave an example of Covalent and others who have been around for a while, right? And obviously I've known Covalent since the early days because we were sort of in the similar boat as well, because we were also an API company before that. So that was kind of, and Ganesh actually lives not too far away from where I'm calling you, same city. And so I think that's kind of where we want to establish, and we want to incentivize people to build. And I think it's a good platform. And at the same time, we've been also internally thinking, how do you make mini hackathons, which are just always happening, right? That'll be pretty cool, where you don't have to wait for an event, because like our core has been open source for a year. Our documentation is out there. We even launched this DevNet recently because we realized that people need something where they can play around with. A lot of our stuff is very production oriented because we look at production data, because we look at Ethereum data. And we wanted to build something where, okay, you can sort of build with that. So, but yeah, my coolest thing is whether they build on Powerloom or not, I always love seeing good hacks. And I think one of the ones I judged, I'm trying to remember the name. It had a Windows 95 interface, because I'm that old that I was like, it brought back nostalgia for me. And they had built all these dApps on it. So it's called Win something. And they were there in the top 10. I saw it on the London one. And so it was just something really, really cool, right? It was not the most, technically complicated one. There were far more ones. Somebody had built a decentralized Oracle. That was probably the hardest one I had felt. And they had built it literally in 3 days, apparently. I will take their word for the thing. But, you know, this was something cool. So it's hackathons is also that. And then when you sort of go on to solve a problem for you, like, you know, you're deep in that decentralized social space. So now you're not only building it because it's fun, but you're solving a problem, right? Then others would want to use your hack. And I think that's sort of, I mean, this is like my personal goal as well. It's not just for Powerloom. I would continue doing this for the rest of my life if I can, to help developers build a cool thing.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you in terms of like hacking under code names. One thing that I do, so I've been building out like this decentralized data platform for several years. It started with a credentialing platform that I built called Orange Protocol a couple of years ago, where the customer were DAOs, and so we were helping them, create these credentials for their contributors based on certain on-chain or off-chain actions. And then we would then abstract that any private data, because initially it was issued as a verifiable credential, so off-chain at the station. And then we would abstract any private data and create an SBT so that there was this on-chain primitive. It has continued to develop. It's become like a loyalty system that we're building with Mosaic. Trying to bring this.
Dude, that's like the first thing I helped a project. It was called Spring Roll. We were trying to build a better LinkedIn. Yeah. It was like attestations, and that's like it's like one of my favorite things. I'm so glad. I want to now check it out after the
call. Oh heck yeah, go check it out. I'm not working on that one specifically anymore. I've handed it off, but I've definitely.
What is it called?
Orange Protocol.
Orange.
Yeah, and then right now the site that we have live for the current iteration of what we're envisioning is mosaicdrops.com. And then I developed Far Drops at the hackathon. And there's now a working group to try to figure out what Superfans is going to look like. So all of this for me is like, I'm a creator first, right? Like the one thing that I've done before coming into Web3 was always a hobby, was like, content creation. When I came into Web3, the easiest way for me to create value, was educational content. How can we talk about like these very complex systems, make it super simple? The podcast is an iteration of that. Crypto Sapiens is, you know, a big vision of that, supported by a bunch of like really cool people like Eureka John, who's backstage helping us produce this podcast. So my vision is like, how can we bring all this like creative energy together to like maximize the impact that individual creators can have using Web3 Rails? And so Orange Protocol, while initially was narrowly focused in DAOs, started kind of on that vision. Mosaic Drops has continued with that. Far Drops has like really narrowed that to a very specific decentralized social platforms. And Superfans is like, how can we create a whole social experience? So OnlyFans is definitely the inspiration behind that. How can we create the crypto or on-chain version of that? Stay tuned. Obviously, tons of alpha there that I haven't really shared before, but since you asked, there it is.
Is it Farcaster specific, or is it just going to be any social?
So initially, because we just have such a big audience on Farcaster, it's going to be Farcaster specific, but I have friends over at Lens, and there's just tons of other decentralized socials.
There's a lot of cool things happening. I was actually a very early Lens user because of Stani.
Yep.
But he's one of the early backers of PowerDoom, and I just met him at a Lens meetup in London, and I was surprised to see a lot of the apps are actually way more polished than what I even use on Farcaster. I'm like, this is cool. I didn't even know this existed. I've had that profile and all those things, but again, it's a bit of traction thing and how people perceive it. I would say probably Lens was bigger at that point. And who knows, right? I actually feel that they shouldn't only be one thing. We have this obsession in crypto where it's such a this winner or this is the biggest one. Why does it matter? The whole point of on-chain is we should have more options, and people will pick, and there should be collaboration between both the protocols, and that is what will make it super cool. On the hacking side, I don't know how much alpha I can reveal today. We're dropping hints. We're dropping hints. I'm waiting for Pratik to drop a video. He's going to drop a video. He's dropped enough hints on Farcaster. So if you follow him there, you have an idea what's coming. So I was hacking something yesterday for the first time on Frame. So I was building my first Frame for integration for something we're announcing hopefully Tuesday. It'll be super cool. It's very simple. It's the first step of everything that we're doing with the next month. We have a lot of other cool things planned. We have these terms called KOLs, right? So internally, I joke about it that you don't need our team doesn't need a Farcaster KOL.
Yeah.
We just have one who's so engaged in that community. I get a lot of insights, right? It's also more organic insights, which I really appreciate. It's super helpful for me to know what's happening there. And then across, we got Elon's attention the other day.
Yeah.
Someone said, Vitalik's not on Twitter anymore. He's like, what happened? I'm like, oh shit, now all Farcaster links are going to get blocked. I'm so scared now.
Oh man. Yeah. I think, who has the best strategy for Farcaster links is Dan Romero. Obviously, I think he's doing this QR codes. So smart, because links
he invited me way back. He's the one who invited me as well. So yeah. I'm like, I feel like he always puts out the QR code, so he knows the algo.
Yep. Really heck well. Yeah. I mean, he's been early to Twitter too. So, I think he knows a thing or two about the platform. I don't want to press you too hard on this, but one of my next questions, I guess, was going to be what do you think will be kind of like, or maybe not, what do you think, more so, how can PowerLoom continue to expand on its vision using some of the more innovative, emergent platforms that are coming up? So Farcaster is a good way. So you talked about you're hacking something. It's going to be announced. It's Frames. You don't want to tell us what it is yet. It's okay. This podcast is called
Alpha. It's just for a small thing. I can definitely talk about the larger thing, which is about data, right? So data is not something that's secret. This is just for our... we are doing something for a very specific... Oh, I have to be so careful what I say. Because I don't want to ruin the market. Look, we have a nice process of marketing. There's approvals and things. So I don't want to reveal something before the thing is out.
Don't make Pratik mad at me, okay? But let us know at least the vision of what that looks like. It doesn't have to be specific.
For PowerLoom, it doesn't matter, right? Because this is all... As long as it's on-chain, this is what I say, right? If it's on-chain, you can start to build it on PowerLoom right away, right? For example, I've been thinking about, obviously we didn't do anything at the Frameworks hackathon, but even at scaling Ethereum, if people want to build something like the idea just suggested to you, they could be doing it right away. So it just requires that little bit of business logic. That means that somebody has to write some code. The good thing is you can write it in any language because our protocol doesn't have that kind of a framework specific thing. But that also makes it a bit more, you'll have to look at our templates on how we have built on, I think we have built a few things on Python, Node.js and Go and a few languages, but someone has to put a little more effort right now. And that's what our goal is this year, to abstract that away as much as possible and reduce it. I think we've already reduced a lot from like 3 months ago. If you go through the GitHub history, it was a lot more complex at the previous, I think, the ETH India Hackathon. And now it's, you can use that, these compute modules and things like that. So that's where our focus is. The other thing is chains itself, right? Like, for example, we are trying to expand to other EVM chains. The good thing is the way Paulum is built and the way it works, it's just a simple configuration change. If you just say that, hey, I want to support, let's say, from Ethereum to Base. I think I just revealed something. But okay, never mind. If you want to switch to Base. And for example, I mean, it's kind of open source. So if you look at our Uniswap use case, and we have one for Aave that we haven't announced yet, but it's almost sort of soft launched. And that particular one, you can just switch that to Base or Optimism or any of these chains where it's actually doing better because there's more liquidity or whatever it is, and it'll just start to work out of the box. You don't even have to write code. That's the good part. Now, the question is, if we start to move to other chains, for example, Aptos is what I think Strani and me were just chatting about, that I think Aave's already done the governance on it. So it's the first sort of non-EVM chain as well. How do you sort of move to that, right? Which is going to take a little more effort because someone has to learn on Move. But the good thing is, Paulum, as a protocol, treats everything the same way, because we just say, as long as it's on chain, the protocol will still function as it is, because it doesn't care. It just needs to make sure that the anchor point is something that can be verified. We don't deal with off-chain data right now. We used to. We realized that that's a whole another Chainlink Oracle sort of territory that we don't want to deal with. And this is a lot more simpler as well. It's also more easy to challenge. So let's say you and I are like, hey, somebody's doing something wrong on the Paulum protocol. We should be able to solo challenge it. So I think that's kind of where it is. Use cases wise, I think, yeah, we want to expand beyond DeFi, gaming, everything where we talk about. I think social is, it's great. It's catching up so much that if other people can build really powerful applications using Paulum, and if the clients especially, right, these clients that are sort of, you know, this is the biggest thing. So to give you some history, I built one of the first Twitter's third-party clients. This was TweetDeck was already there. This is 2009 or 2008. 2008, I joined Twitter. And then by end of 2008, I had come up with this idea. So Twitter used to not be used by on the official website. People used to not go. So it was like 30 or 40%, and 60 to 70% used to be on third-party apps. So I had a product called Filter. We used to cut out spam, which I thought at that time was spam. Now it's crazy. But we even had AI, if I think about it. It's so weird. We were early, too early. We were essentially a client, right? And I remember we got OAuth access, but one day Twitter just cut us off because of some reason. And that was my learning lesson, that you cannot ever rely. But here, this is the beauty, right? Paulum as a protocol doesn't censor anything. If you want to go take part in that network, you can sort of submit you can even go and say, hey, I need this data, and someone can come in and you can provide a bounty. And like today, we are obviously subsidizing this ourselves by, you know, as a foundation and things, we are trying to incentivize developers and our snapshotters as well to snapshot this data. But eventually that's the thing, right? Once we hit mainnet, you'll be able to go and demand this data, and someone might be like, oh, this is worth building. And then there's the other audience, which is like, this is worth snapshotting that data. So then it means that other apps can utilize it, and then the clients can become even lighter. They don't need a backend, right, to do. Like right now, that's a slight bit of a challenge where they have to use API keys and all those things. So we want to simplify that. And I think that's where I have like 100 of these ideas, to be honest. I wish, I always joke internally, if I could clone, I would be hacking on our own protocol and building all these use cases. But, you know, I think there are way smarter people than me, because when I go to hackathons, I see them. So my hope is by end of this year, I would love to have somebody like you, you know, building on top of our room. That would be super cool.
Well, definitely. I feel like the perfect test for how accessible your no code platform is send it to me and I'll let you know. Cause while my background is in is very technical, I really have not been paying too close attention. So a lot of like the what they call low code platforms even have a learning barrier, right? Like there's still a barrier to usability. So send it to me, I'll let you know, and we'll keep
hopefully refining. We'll get there. That's my internal milestone for this year, build that sort of low-code, no-code platform, because it's not easy, right? We are not Dune, or even Dune is actually technical when I sort of think about it. Like, it's not so easy for someone to do it, but it's far more low-code. So we want to get to that level. Again, in decentralized protocols, it's kind of hard to build low-code, no-code. And who knows, maybe somebody will build that on top of our protocol, which is basically a low-code, a no-code version of PowerLoom. And that'll be super cool. Well, maybe that should be the bounty.
Yeah, that's the beauty of like just either open source or Web3 development in general, just because of a lot of the on-chain elements of what we're building is there's that built-in composability. So someone can easily build on top of that protocol. And to me, that's really exciting. And that's why I'm here.
You don't need the core dev's permission, or you don't need to do. And this is, correct. I think that's what, honestly, that's what keeps me going, because I think for the last 7 years, there's been a lot of ups and downs, but I always think about like how, when we launched and when we did this thing called a mint. And there was a, I won't go into the history, that story of it, with, we were working with a provider who was supposed to help us with certain things, didn't work out for whatever reason. And over the holidays, we just decided, how do we open up? So we, to give you some context, we had about probably 50-100 peers on our network at that time. And we were trying to figure out, how do we scale this to 1,000 peers? And I remember Sandeep and I met in India, and we were just talking about, oh, let's do some sort of an infrastructure thing on Polygon. And I'm like, but no one's kind of done that. And then over the holidays, I started just like thinking, oh, we can just use our snapshotters. And what if we scale that? So we actually came up with this goal of 10,000 snapshotters. And we are actually more than halfway through already. And we did this mint on Polygon. And the difference between, let's say, a centralized provider to what we were able to do is anyone can go and mint this, essentially this NFT. Obviously, there's a certain cost associated with it. I'm going to throw out a disclaimer. Please read before you do that what it does, and please understand it. It's not for trading. It's also not transferable. It's an SBT. So, but it essentially allows you to become a snapshot on a network. And that way, it really is something I didn't have to deal with a third party. It was like, just put out a smart contract. It was a bit scary when we launched that contract, because we were like, what if somebody, figures out the flaw and all those things. But, you know, we trusted that, okay, well, we'll figure out when we get to that point. But it's been awesome. And it's like, individuals who don't even have tech experience, they are able to run these PowerLoom nodes right now, and they are running it on their VPSs. Some of them are running it on their computers. Obviously, some the geeks like me, who are probably running it on Raspberry Pis and things like that, just to prove the decentralization. And we had this goal, I think internally, for 100 nodes last year, and now we are at 5,000. And that's kind of, and our end goal is probably hitting that 10,000 before we hit mainnet. And that's kind of where the alpha is for next week. That's what we are announcing, the change. But that's what I wanted to talk about. Like, on-chain allowed us to do something like this without having to ask for, like, I didn't even have to go and ask Polygon team, hey, can you like let us do this on your platform? No, just go and deploy a contract. And if enough people think it's worthwhile, they'll go do it. And for us as well, it allows us to not use some sort of a centralized API to know who's actually gotten that SBT or who doesn't, and give that way to do it. And, you know, at mainnet, we want it to be 100% decentralized, so that it's completely, you know, just like Ethereum has been my inspiration. So for me, like, I'm an early ETH staker as well. So like, that's kind of where we want to reach, right? Where you have true exits and entries of people who want to be peers in the network. So I think this is something, it's so hard when I have to explain to my Web2 friends what we are doing and what impact it has, because otherwise you have to ask like Google for permission to even open an account, or like servers or with AWS, and you have to put a credit card and they can just take your servers away at whatever, right? Like, all these things are so hard to like explain. And this is just a tiny piece of what we do, right? And that itself is, I think, it's just fascinating. And I think that's what, it's like the motivation as well in a way to keep doing.
Yeah, I laughed a little bit when you said your Web2 friends. I'm like, you still have Web2 friends? I know. I definitely, my Web2 friends are my family for sure. But I think I spend way too much time in the digital space talking to the Web3 community, especially like I said, Farcaster. Well, we're almost at the top of the hour, so I'll make sure that we covered everything that we need to. Anything that's left unsaid here that we need to be covering before we close out?
I mean, I would advise people to go check out the protocol. Our Discord is pretty active, especially the snapshotter discussions. You might not see much on the general channel, but you do, I believe, to participate in that, you do need the SPD, but you can read all the messages. So that's not, it's open to everyone. Our documentation is public. You can, you know, take part in the DevNet. You can actually see how PowerLoom works, the whole process of what I talked about, the minting thing. There's no cost associated with that for the on the DevNet. You just need Sepolia ETH. If you don't have Sepolia ETH, there's a faucet, I believe, which will give you that as well to test it out as a dev. And as an end user, if you just want to learn about it as well, like we sort of have a lot of content about what we're doing. We're going to be pushing out more content. We have certain use cases, like with the Uniswap one, we have ones with Aave. And yeah, if you're a hacker like Humpty who wants to build something super cool at the next hackathon, we'll be sponsoring the one at Scaling Ethereum. And we're just putting out some of the bounties up. What we'll be doing, our team will be supporting. We are very global as well. So follow us on, I think on Twitter, we are PowerLoom HQ. Discord is also linked there, but it's just /PowerLoom. And the website is powerloom.io for people to check it out.
Amazing. Well, Sarup, thank you so much for your time. This has been really fun. It's been good to get to know you, not just like, you know, what you're doing at PowerLoom, but, you know, outside of it.
And very different from what I do usually on the podcast, because we go so deep into like, hey, PowerLoom. So we just went off, like we were just talking about like entrepreneurship to this and that, like on-chain and social. So that was like, it's awesome to have like conversations. I think we'll take some cues for our Data Launcher podcast as well, which is also being done at the same time as this is done.
So. Amazing. Well, definitely look me up when you're ready. I would love to come on and also be on your podcast. But again, thank you so much for coming on. We'll definitely be keeping a close eye on Farcaster and Pratik's messages in terms of what's happening there pretty soon.
Turn on notifications. I don't know if that's a thing on Farcaster, but
there are notifications. So I'm definitely going to turn it on. Cool. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.